Reports were to hand that our bombardment had well cut the German wire. About 4:30 a.m. on the 1st of July, following an almost sleepless night of work and tension, I rose and shaved. There was not enough water for washing. I slipped on my tunic and my boots to feel properly dressed for likely enough the last time. At 6:25 on a still, fine, hazy morning, our artillery reopened the bombardment after a lull. This immediately drew from the Germans a heavy reply. At 7:22 a.m, our mortars joined in the tumult. Simultaneously, the 2nd Middlesex and the 2nd Devonshires, climbing out of their trenches by short ladders placed on the fire steps, crept through the lanes in our wire. Each battalion then extended in four waves to cover about 300 yards of frontage and crawled forward to begin crossing the 600 to 800 yards of no man's land. 8 minutes afterwards, on the tick of 0 hour and following the explosion of mines under the La Boisselle salient, our field gun barrage, till then falling on the first German trench line, lifted to a further line. Both battalions, rising to their feet, now advanced in quick time through the rank, knee-deep grass, the four waves at 100 paces interval. A hail of bullets from the shell holes clear of the blasted German trenches in front, as well as from either flank at La Boisselle and Auvillay, presently mowed down the three leading waves, now breaking into a charge. In spite of this, about 200 of the Middlesex pressed into the enemy's front line, and a few even into the support line in the rear. Scarcely any of the Devonshire, which had also suffered terribly, were able to enter the hostile trenches at all. Those of both battalions who succeeded in gaining an entry fought hand to hand with bayonet and bomb, till they'd either become casualties or were forced to retire some 2 hours later to the scanty cover afforded by the grass and weeds in no man's land, there to await the friendly mantle of night before withdrawing to their lines of that morning. The sun had dispersed the morning haze, and the day promised to be warm. On the upward slope behind us lay many bodies of the West Yorkshires. No man's land was strewn with prone forms. Up against the hostile wire, they showed thickly, the regimental helmet badge being easily recognised on some. Not all of these were casualties, however. Among them were men driven out of the German trenches and taking what cover they could in shell holes. These men remained still as the dead to avoid drawing fire till darkness should screen their escape. Others, not so close to danger, would make a dash or crawl patiently towards our trenches, sniped at on the way. These words were written in one of the most famous accounts of the First World War, called General Jack's Diary, written J.L. Jack, who was serving with the 2nd Battalion of the West Yorkshires on the 1st of July 1916, the worst day in the history of the British Army. He saw what happened, and this was his conclusions. The reaction from this dreadful day, one of the worst I've ever experienced, was so great that, having seen to the relief of my companies, I was forced to ask the Colonel's permission to withdraw ahead of him. Accompanied, therefore, by an orderly, kindly sent by Sandy, I quitted the field on which such brilliant success had been expected that fine summer morning, leaving behind, dead or maimed, in that vast garden of scarlet wild poppies, some 90% of the officers and about 60% of the other ranks of the 12 infantry battalions of my division. Exhausted and depressed, I stumbled into our bivouac at Millencourt at 6 o'clock on the morning of the 2nd of July. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And it really does come from the battlefields this week, because last week I spent 5 days walking the battlefields of the Somme and Arras with two great supporters of the podcast, Michael and Susan White from Melbourne, who were making their 5th visit with me over to the Somme battlefields. They came with me as we walked and discovered the stories in the fields and on the headstones. And I was also accompanied by a good friend of mine, John Foster, So at times during the episode this week, you'll hear their voices as well as they react to the stories, those stories from the battlefields. It's the first time that I've used a new microphone that I bought recently, and it's really effective in keeping out what wind there was. It was quite still, but occasionally you'll hear crackles as me being an amateur broadcaster. I had the microphone perhaps too close to my face, clipped to my jacket, and there is the occasional noise, which I hope doesn't spoil the podcast too much. But there's some really, really powerful stories this week. So without any further ado, let's go over to that village of Ovillers, right in the middle of the Somme battlefield of the 1st of July, 1916.
Mash Valley, 1st of July, 1916. Anticipating the distant future whilst writing in 1929, there was a man called Charles Dury, and he came here in 1929, before moving on to Teepval. And he said, for many years to come, stray travellers will revisit the ground where once they fought and endured, where many of their friends lie forever. But the time must come when the travellers are seen no more, and only the forest of graves above the Onc, the River Onc, will remain to tell the tale of the island race whose sons once were lords of these woods and fields. And the author of this book says, today, the different interpretations which people who often have no experience of conflict place on such words can mean that his understanding of the war can seem out of place in a war in Europe changed far beyond that distance soldiers' imaginings. Mm. You know, so they were wondering whether anybody would return here. So all along, oh yeah, they talked about the two large mines being detonated at Lotnagar and Wysat. Mm. And all along, so it's the 8th Division Front that are attacking towards us here on the 1st of July. The final intensification of the artillery barrage began at 7:22 a.m., supplemented by the fire of three Stokes mortar sections beyond each brigade, and that marked the opportunity for men to move out into no man's land to try and reduce the amount of no man's land they're going to cross, which must be 800 yards here. The leading waves moved forward 200 to 300 yards, so quite a long way. But throughout it was apparent that the machine gunners in Ovillers were not subdued, and at least two guns, machine guns, constantly swept the area of no man's land north of Le Boisselle, which is where we are. Some way to their right, the detonation of the mines at Le Boisselle at 7:28 created both a spectacular outburst of flame and a gigantic plume of debris, which gusts skywards in the most devastated and awesome sound of shockwaves yet heard in warfare. So one of the brigades facing Ovillers, 25th Brigade within the 8th Division, it was estimated to have been presented with the easiest of the targets. The 70th Brigade was impotent to cope with the terrible intensity of fire and machine gun fire emanating from the Ovillers defences. The 2nd Royal Barks, they were unable to make any progress, and to their north, initially moving in lines, but then progressing by short rushes from shell hole to shell hole, men of the 2nd Lincolns actually gained the German front line northwest of Ovillers. So over there, not in front of Ovillers. Small parties then pressed on towards the 2nd Trench, where they were eventually compelled to withdraw in the face of counterattacks by bombers and persistent enfilade fire from both flanks. The 70 or so remaining men who had survived the attack were organising defence of these front lines west of Ovillers by Lieutenant Colonel Reginald Bassard. The Lieutenant Colonel was now commanding the remnants of three battalions and was determined to continue the attack if support came. Calmly and professionally on each flank, he ordered men to block the trenches with barbed wire, as well as organising searches for dugouts that had been uncleared and stocks of German hand grenades. Here they held on for more than 90 minutes until they were driven out by counterattacks. Their supplies of ammo ran low. As they staggered back into the shelter of shell holes in no man's land, they came across the remains of the support waves, hundreds of dead and dying men. You know, that's what they were going to be hoping would continue their attack beyond Ovillers. The 1st Royal Irish Rifles in immediate support had been decimated, not by machine guns, but by the German barrage as they attempted to cross and leave the British trenches only 10 men having got over to join the parties within the German trenches opposite. Total casualties in the 8th Division on that day, so they'd have about 15,000 men in their division, was 5,121, including more than 1,900 killed and 3,000 wounded. Seven of the divisional COs were casualties, and opposite them was the German 180th Regiment, and they lost just 78 men killed and 124 wounded during the preliminary bombardment. The defence of Auvillers by the Germans on that day was undertaken by just two battalions of that 180th Regiment, and their total casualties during the attack was just four officers and 79 men killed, three officers and 181 men killed and 13 missing. The stark contrast of the British with over 5,000 casualties coming in the other direction. And then we move on to the 3rd of July. 2 days later, nothing happened on the 2nd, not really. At 3:15 a.m. on the 3rd, following an hour of intensive bombardment, as matters evolved, the left attack at Serre, which they were going to do up in the north, didn't happen. And it meant that the Germans could put all their efforts into defending Auvillers down here. Unfortunately for the Tommies facing Auvillers, just 20 minutes before their attack was due, the attacks in the neighbouring areas had been cancelled, and it meant that the Germans could put all of their fire into here. They attacked here on their own, basically, on a narrow front without protection on the flanks. The outcome was predictable. Nevertheless, the bombardment opened spectacularly and optimistically at 2:15 a.m. The Corps artillery, as well as batteries belonging to the 12th Division and brigades from 19th Artillery. To improve the chances of success, a number of new assembly trenches had been dug overnight, and that reduced no man's land from 800 to 500 yards. The right of the attack against the south was undertaken by the 35th Brigade, which included men from the Royal Barks and Royal Kents, and included in that attack on that day was my great uncle Henry. It says operation orders instructed the men to crawl forward into no man's land within easy assaulting distance during the final 10 minutes of the bombardment. And at the end of the bombardment, the barrage would lift on a line running through the church. And after a further 30 minutes, the bombardment would lift to the other side of the village, early sign. So even before the attack began at 3:15, the German artillery started firing back on the British assembly positions in the front line and also the communication trenches. Eight waves of soldiers started moving across no man's land. They were relatively free from artillery shelling. Some had got significantly far forward before zero to be able to surprise the Germans in the front line. Such timing was a classical use of the dawn attack, though as yet the sun hadn't yet risen, and it gave them a chance to use the half light to get on top of the Germans. The men pressed forward as best they could. In the frontage attack by the Berkshires, there were many gaps in the German wire where the shelling had gouged deep shell holes, which hugely impacted the progress of each man. So they've got to go down into a shell hole and up out the other side. In the Berkshires war diary, there's a vivid account written by the battalion CO, and he says many dugouts in the German line were bombed, and it became obvious that unless we could procure a supply of bombs, it would be impossible to hold on to the ground we'd gained. It proved to be a very dark morning, and in the darkness it was extremely difficult to recognise friend from foe. Or even the trenches themselves had become considerably damaged by a shell fire, besides which the noise of the bombardment, which had now lifted to the outskirts of the village, and the fire of machine guns was deafening, and it made impossible to hear orders being given. The German dugouts appear to have been quite undamaged by the heavy bombardments. This was the first they knew, because it's the first time they'd got close to them. And as soon as we commenced to throw bombs into them, the enemy swarmed out of the entrances further along, fully armed with bombs, so there was no doubt that they were connected by some means underground. So they're connected by tunnels, these dugouts. The commanding officer and the adjutant went forward shortly after the last wave had left. It was still dark, impossible to discern faces 50 yards away. On reaching the German front line, about 100 men were found between there and the second line. Considerable bombing was heard on the right and in front. The enemy could be seen advancing from the left. There was much confusion in the dark, and men from the Suffolk and the Essex were seen to be mixed up with their own men. The noise was deafening. It was impossible to make oneself heard. the bulk of the men fell back to the German frontline trench. So some of them got into the village.
Yeah.
Some were inclined to go further. Others stuck on the top of the trench and appeared not to know what to do. Only one officer can be found in the locality, and he was endeavouring to rally the men and get them to go forward. Now dawn has broken. It was impossible for the British observers to see what was going on because of all the smoke. The reality was they were being worn out. Although supported by two companies of the Buffs, which is what my uncle was in, who had also got across early, they were now cut off inside the village of Ovillay. The German artillery barrage pounded the British lines. They couldn't get their full supports and reinforcements up. No, the machine guns raked no man's land, and it was impossible to get any more support or reserve battalions across no man's land. It says that after a brief recce, the commanding officer decided that it would be quite impossible to retain our hold on the German frontline trench, which was almost entirely obliterated and extremely deep, as we were exposed, as we were, to an attack from both flanks, as well as from the front. It would have been impossible to consolidate it sufficiently in the time available, added to the fact that we should probably have had to remain there throughout the entire day, unsupported and cut off, and with no bombs or small arms ammunition. By this time, the enemy had started a deadly crossfire with machine guns across no man's land, so the CO officer withdrew what men he could collect and made them dig in on the Albert to Ovillay sunken road, which is the road that's just over there in front of those houses. This road afforded complete protection from the north and was enfiladed from the east. About 80 to 100 men were dug in here and remained there throughout the day, quite unmolested. They were drawn by order. As soon as it was dark, Lieutenant and Adjutant Gold was killed on this road just behind the CO. And then the men who were left in the German trenches were now being hunted down by the Germans mercilessly. They were exhausted physically and didn't have any ammo, water or grenades. And as early as 9 o'clock that morning, the 12th Division realised that their attack was a complete failure. 2,400 officers and men were casualties here, on top of the 5,000 from a couple of days earlier. And the 3rd Berkshire's War Diary says the battalion now consisted of about 70 men and their commanding officer, and they were ordered to go to Albert for the night. Here the men made bivouac shelters, and the officers and NCOs who'd been left at the transport lines rejoined, because remember they left 10% of their men behind in case this happened, and cookers were brought up. In the evening, second lieutenants Breach and May and about 60 men who'd been dug in no man's land rejoined us, and we were all very glad to see them. And then it took a few more days then, another week or so, for more attacks. And eventually the Germans withdrew from Ovillay because it was no longer possible to hold it. And then there's this journalist called Philip Gibbs.
Yes.
You've heard of him?
I have.
He was here. He came here.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, he writes as a professional journalist.
Yes.
The fight for Ovillay had been a hard, bloody and close. Many of our men had died to gain a ground or two of earthwork. There had been great adventures in the capturing of some bits of broken brick or the working round a ditch below the remnants of a wall. Under a steady drive of machine gun bullets sweeping all the ground, men of ours from Cheshire and another English county in the north had crept forward at night with a few hand grenades and flung themselves against the enemy's bombing posts and barricades and fought fiercely to smash down the sandbags or brickwork and get a few more yards of clear ground. They have sapped their way underground and blown up the roofs of vaults where Germans lay in hiding with machine guns. They fought in small parties, gaining isolated points in the southern part of the village and holding on to them under heavy fire until only a few men remained alive but still held on. There have been fights to the death between a handful of English or Irish soldiers and a dozen or more Germans. This is desperate hand-to-hand fighting like Poisier. English, Irish soldiers meeting Germans, meeting each other in the deep darkness of cellars quarried out from the chalk subsoil, and the German gunners peering out of slips in concrete emplacements below ground and firing bursts of bullets down the roadway have found themselves suddenly in the grasp of men covered in white clay rising out of holes in the earth with no weapons but their picks. So the Germans are covered in this white clay in the dugouts. They've spent all their ammunition. They come out to fight using picks. Auvillers is a place of abdominal ruin. There is nothing left of it except dust. There's not a wall standing 2 feet high or a bit of a wall. The guns have swept it flat. But underground, there are still great cellars, quarried out by inhabitants who have long fled. And in these, the Germans are holding out against their attacks now, our attacks and our bombardments. Heavy shells have opened up some of them and filled them with dead and wounded, and many still stand strong. And out of them come the enemy machine guns and bombers to make counterattacks against the ditches and debris which our men are working forward. The ground is pitted with enormous shell holes in which men lie buried. Auvillers is perhaps more ghastly than any ruined ground along the front. And then we sit here now on a beautiful early spring day, looking out where there's no, we can't see a soul. And we know that at least 8,000 to 10,000 men were either maimed, killed, blown to pieces where we're sitting. Not a breath of wind, not a care in the world for us. The field has been ploughed. Like we said on the way up, I wonder how many stories that those fields could tell us of those thousands of men that are still there.
It really is. The contrast is so stark. It's hard to...
Sometimes it isn't when you're here. Sometimes it's a horrible day. Yeah. Although it wasn't a horrible day when these men met their maker here. The horrible day makes you... It seems appropriate.
Yes, it seems appropriate.
But today,
it
doesn't.
Too beautiful.
It's too beautiful. And like we said, you know, Gibbs went up and down the front line at the beginning of July, looking at the Metz and Tietvau, and he's just said this is possibly the worst spot on the Somme battlefield up to that point. He's writing time. He's not writing years later.
He's writing as
it's happening.
As he's seeing it.
So what we did next, and what I want to do for you, is then have a wander around the cemetery, just looking at a few of the random graves. No one famous apart from one story, but just picking a few stories to tell of men that died in and around Auvillers and now lay at rest in Auvillers Military Cemetery. This cemetery is located just to the west of what was the German fortified village of Auvillers, and it was initially set up as a battle cemetery behind a dressing station shortly after the village had been captured in early July of 1916. And it was used until March 1917. And at that stage, there was only 143 graves in the cemetery there. But afterwards, after the armistice, it was used as a concentration cemetery with burials brought in from the surrounding battlefields here at Auvillers, at Poisiers, at La Boisselle across the road, and at Contalmaison. And there was two cemeteries that were in the area. One was called Mash Valley Cemetery, and one was called Red Dragon Cemetery, both in Auvillers. They were both closed down, and the burials there, 76 in Mash Valley and just 25 in Red Dragoon. They were concentrated into Auvillers. And there's now 3,440 Commonwealth servicemen either buried or commemorated in the cemetery, and nearly 2,500 of those are unidentified. And there's also 120 French war graves here, reminding us, as we're going to find out a bit later, that the French fought here before the British arrived in the middle of 1915. And the cemetery was designed by one of the prominent Imperial War Graves Commission architects, as it was then, Sir Herbert Baker. So the first of the stories that I wanted to talk about was a man called William Woods. And we wandered over to a special memorial. He's one of 35 soldiers that are remembered just inside the entrance on the right-hand side by the perimeter wall. He's thought to be buried here, but his actual location, the actual grave, has been lost at some stage, which is why he does have a headstone, but it's called a special memorial because the exact location of William's body cannot be confirmed. It's not certain as to where it is.
So this is William Woods. He volunteered, became an officer, and the 3rd of July, serving with the Suffolks, is his first day in action.
Oh, right.
On that 3rd of July, at 3:15 dawn attack here. Yeah. and they know he's involved in the attack. You know, he's only been here on the battlefield for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And he simply disappears on that day.
Okay.
And the family back home in Northampton, they're hoping he's been taken prisoner. All the usual thoughts go through their heads.
Yeah.
And then eventually they get a letter from a colleague, a comrade, that said that he died over there within yards of jumping out of the trench.
Yeah.
Come on, men, follow me. He's riddled with machine gun bullets. And he's buried here to the memory of 35 soldiers of the British Empire, killed in action and buried at the time in Mash Valley Cemetery, Ovillay, whose graves were later destroyed in later battles. All these 35 men have been buried in this area, including William Woods from Northampton. And then there's this man here, Lieutenant Colonel Faulkner Sandys, who'd been awarded the ESO Distinguished Service Order before the war, and he's commanding the Middlesex Regiment here within the 8th Division on the 1st of July, not the 3rd, on the 1st.
Yeah.
And we know what happened to him through a newspaper article dated September the 14th, 1916, so two months later. A tragic story, it says, was told at a Westminster inquest today of Lieutenant Colonel Edwin Thomas Faulkner Sandys of the Middlesex Regiment, who died in St George's Hospital in London as a result of a bullet wound, but not a bullet wound that he picked up here. On September the 6th, Sandys, who'd taken a room at the Cavendish Hotel in London, was found in bed with a revolver in his hand. There was a bullet wound in his head, and he was removed to hospital, where he died yesterday. Captain Lloyd Jones of the same regiment said that Sandys was single, aged about 40, and resided at the Bath Club. He'd been wounded 5 times and been awarded the DSO, so he was a brave soldier.
Yeah.
Since he left hospital, the deceased had been greatly depressed and was very much distressed because of the attack on the 1st of July, when his battalion suffered severely. He'd never threatened suicide before, but said he'd wished he'd been killed alongside his men. On September the 6th, the witness received a letter from Sandys which contained the following. I've come to London today to take my life. I've never had a moment's peace since the 1st of July. Captain R.J. Young of the same regiment said he was in the attack on the 1st of July when the battalion suffered severely and the deceased was wounded. Sandys had been greatly depressed since, and in a letter which the witness received from him on that day, he wrote, by the time you receive this, I shall be dead. The coroner remarked that the case revealed a pathetic tragedy of a very distinguished soldier who thought less of his own wounds than he did the loss of his own men. He couldn't stand the thought that he'd survived, despite being wounded in this field, that he'd survived and so many of his men that looked up to him, those young men had died. He wasn't a young man, he was aged about 40 years old. What about Captain John Lauder? So, Scotsman. This is young Lauder, Captain John Lauder. This is his father, Harry, who was a famous musician at the time. And he came here to see his son's grave, you know, when this was a temporary cemetery.
Yeah.
So John was the only son of Harry Lauder, the Scottish entertainer, who was one of the richest entertainers of the time. And he left behind his devastated parents, Harry and Nancy, and he had a fiancée called Mildred. His final letter home to Mildred was written on Boxing Day of 1916.
Oh. Oh, wow.
And it says, "Sweetheart mine, I've just had breakfast in bed. I'm waiting for my shaving water to come. My, if only I had hold of you now. I should squeeze and cuddle you something awful. Christmas has passed now, and now New Year is rushing down on us. The days go by very rapidly. Nevertheless, it is ages since I last saw you, slowly fading from view, waving a white handkerchief. I felt jolly sad that night. My shaving water is present and correct, so I'll carry on. Later, sweetheart, until later in the day, John. Two kisses." Mildred was heartbroken, obviously, she never married.
Okay.
Mm.
3 days after her death in 1975, the Lauder Thompson, that was her surname, Thompson Ward, was opened at Erskine Hospital, and that cared for ex-service personnel. It was paid for by Mildred in memory of the man that she'd loved but never got the chance to marry.
Oh, that's so sad.
The father, Harry, he learned of his son's death on New Year's Day, you know, 4 days later.
Mm.
And later in 1917, he came to France. On that trip, he came to visit his son's grave. He said, "We set out across a field that had been ripped and torn by shellfire. All about us there were little brown mounds, each with a white wooden cross upon it. All over the valley was thickly sown with white crosses, and my own grief was altered by the vision of grief that has come to so many others. In the presence of so many evidences of grief and desolation, a private grief sank into its true perspective. So we came, when we were perhaps a mile from the Bapaume Road, to a slight eminence, a tiny hill that rose from the field. A little military cemetery at that stage crowned it. British boys lie sleeping in that small acre of silence, and among them is my own laddie. They're the fondest hopes of my life, the hopes that sustained and cheered me through the many years lie buried. I went alone to my boy's grave, and I flung myself down on the warm, friendly earth. I was utterly spent. And maybe that gave him some kind of closure, possible to say, but at least he could let go of that grief here on this spot where we're standing now. Sidney Rogerson was here. He wrote a book called 12 Days, 2nd West Yorks, within the 8th Division here. He said, some of us remember that sunny last evening in June when we had assembled with high hopes in the trenches opposite Ovillers and La Boisselle. How we jested and joked, even collecting pieces of chalk wherewith to label our own trophies the guns were so sure of taking. Some of us too remember the next night when, with every officer but one a casualty and our dead hanging thick on the German wire, we'd been withdrawn, sweating and shaking and shattered. Oh yeah, the Buffs, we're talking about the Buffs, my great uncle's battalion that's gone across there. And their official history says this, that the 1st of July was the opening day of the great Somme struggle and the Battle of Albert. 0 hour found the 6th Battalion marching through Millencourt and halted in a field northwest of that village, being of course in reserve. A great deal of firing was heard and some rumours caused a great deal of excitement at first. All objectives had been gained. And then news came through, the assault on Ovillers had failed, which unfortunately was true, as the attack in that sector did not achieve much success on the first day, without putting it mildly.
Yeah.
At 5 p.m, orders came to be ready to move off at a moment's notice into the intermediate line, and the brigade actually moved off at 7 o'clock, finding the greatest difficulty in getting through the congested streets of Millencourt. But at 8:15, orders were changed again. The 12th Division was now to relieve the 8th here. Mm-hmm. Which had suffered many casualties. The move was accomplished at night time, the Buffs with the rest of the division being all in the trenches at 2:45 a.m. Imagine that scene. They're into the frontline trenches, which these survivors from here had crawled back into.
Yeah.
The scene in front of them must have been absolutely awful.
Yeah.
If they could see it, it's 2:45. The second of the month did not bring another important effort by our troops, as this part of the line, although Ovillers was heavily bombarded by the artillery, they couldn't attack. They didn't have enough many men. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know what their orders were. Everything had broken down. There wasn't a plan for this. So at 1:15 a.m. on the 3rd, however, so they've been sitting there in those trenches for 24 hours. Orders came that the village would be attacked at 3:15 after an hour's intense bombardment. The order for the battle was the 7th, 37th Brigade, and that included us, the 6th Battalion, two companies of Buffs, including my great-uncle. After a few casualties sustained by the reason of the usual retaliation to our bombardment, the Queens and the West Kents attacked. Very heavy machine gun flanking fire met the Kentish men from the left and the Queens on the right. A company of the Buffs went over by platoons at 3:30 a.m, just after dawn, and the first wave suffered few casualties until they reached the German wire, which is just down there, close to where. So they've got, remember they dug new assembly trenches.
Yep.
So no man's land is not quite as wide.
Yep.
It's a couple of hundred yards there. Still a long way though, 500 yards is still a long way. German wire was reached. The succeeding waves of this company and those of C Company suffered heavily in the advance. I mean, imagine what they're seeing out there as well from 2 days ago.
Yeah.
You know, in the long grass, the men that have been decapitated, limbs missing, others that are still alive. A few men that succeeded in getting into the German trenches under 2nd Lieutenant Farmer at once commenced to bomb the dugouts. Eyewitnesses report that the accuracy of this advance was remarkable, and it reminded them of field day work. Two communication trenches were found to be blocked. Owing to casualties amongst bomb carriers, the supply of these necessities was soon exhausted and casualties were inflicted by German bombers. So they've run out of bombs. And then the Germans, knowing that, then picked up their own bombs and hurled them at them. The intense enemy machine gun fire also held up the attack, and B&D companies didn't go into the struggle. The German artillery maintained a heavy fire in our trenches with great accuracy and weight. So there's men out here in no man's land trying to get through the wire into the village, and all the time the Germans put machine gun fire and artillery into their own trenches, and the men are not even involved in the attack.
Yeah.
About 7:30 a.m, so that's 4 hours after they've gone in, a message was received that the corps was making another attack preceded by artillery preparation at 8:15 a.m. If successful, 35th Infantry Brigade would cooperate. A message was also received that the 37th Brigade, including the Buffs, were to attack again, with the Buffs in the lead, with the two companies that had not gone in earlier on. It was decided that no further effort should be made on the sector on that day. The East Surreys took over the frontline trenches, and the brigade settled down to be shelled. So they're knowing what's coming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
During the night, a number of wounded were brought in. The casualties of the 3rd of July were for the 6th Battalion Buffs, Captains Lee, 2nd Lieutenants Cox and Hinckley wounded, Captain Child. It just goes on to list them, and it says, total casualties, 11 officers, 263 other ranks. And Hinckley died. It mentioned Hinckley, and he's here. Now, I don't have a photo of him, but we do know, he's a 2nd Lieutenant.
Yeah.
The only son, and this comes through a lot, these stories I've got to tell you. He was the son of the Reverend and Mrs. William Hinckley. So his father is a man of the cloth. They came from India, and the whole family had been in the army previously out in India. He was educated at Packwood and Trent College, where he'd been for years a member of the school OTC, the Officers Training Corps. He was gazetted on the 9th Battalion of the Buffs in the summer of 1915. So he's straight in. He's not been, because of his background, his army background, they considered him suitable
to
be an officer, even though he's only 18 when he's been commissioned. Mm. And after passing a military examination in March 1916, he was sent to the front, and he was transferred to another battalion of his regiment at the age of 18. His commanding officer said of him, "I saw your son start off gallantly leading his men," just behind us here, "and while getting through our wire," not the enemy wire, "our wire, he received a bullet through his thigh and fell." Remember, the Germans are firing low.
Yeah.
So he's got a bullet in his thigh and he's fell, it says. With true heroism, he refused to stop, calling out, "Come on, boys, I won't stop for this," and he pushed on. He was killed between the 1st and 2nd German lines. So the commanding officer, writing home to mum and dad, he's trying to tell us he's got a bullet through the thigh here, and he's managed to get right across no man's land into the German. I find that unlikely. But he says his magnificent courage and example is beyond all praise, and I only trust that if I go under, I may die as gallant a death. So that letter is meant to be comfort to his parents.
Yeah.
So, 2nd Lieutenant Leonard Henry Batson, the Buffs, killed in action, was the eldest child and sole surviving son of the Reverend Batson. Another Reverend,
same
as the one along there. The Vicar of Brookland, and the late Fanny Batson, who was 24 years old, killed on the 3rd of July in a storming of a village and reported missing, but his body was afterwards recovered and buried where he fell, close to the enemy's barbed wire entanglement. He was educated at Harrowview, Ealing, Marlborough College, Keble College, Oxford. Now, this is a bright
Oxford,
lad,
to get to those
places. Gazetted in November 14, right at the beginning of the war, a keen member of the Officer Training Corps at Marlborough and Oxford, and he was in the 2nd Cricket 11.
A talented
lad. John Lee's got a new headstone, look. Got a photograph of him, there he is.
One of the best, it says.
Okay.
John Lee, one of the best, they're all one of the best.
Mm.
It was with deep regret that we recall that Captain John Charles Thomas Lee, eldest son of the Reverend Lee, third in a row, Vicar of Yalding, chairman of the Maidstone Rural District Council, has been killed in France. Official intimation was received by Mr. and Mrs. Lee at the vicarage on Friday, stating that Captain Lee was killed in action on France on Monday, July the 3rd. He was 22 years of age, was educated at Stubbington, and then went to Marlborough College at Oxford, and he was a scholar of Wadham. He joined the OTC of his college and went out to war on June the 1st last year. He was promoted to captain in October. At cricket, he played for his school and also for the Moat Club. and he was also in his school hockey 11. His younger brother, Lieutenant Roland Llewellyn Lee, who is serving with the Royal Garrison Artillery, has been at the front since August of last year. Now, there's good news and bad news.
Okay.
The good news is that Captain Ronald Llewellyn Lee came back from the First World War.
Okay.
But he then went out to the Second World War. Well, he didn't go out to the Second World War. He was serving in the army in the Second World War in a coastal regiment, forming, and he was killed. Mm. He was killed by, I don't know, a German bomb, an air raid or something. Too old to go out and fight. He was killed. There's another lad here that may be buried here amongst all of the unknowns.
Mm.
Sergeant Clark of the Buffs, killed out here. And said, Mr. and Mrs. Clark from Aylesford have been notified of the death of their eldest son, Sergeant Clark, the eldest of three brothers who joined again in September 1914. He's all volunteers. Previous to that, he was employed by a pottery company. His younger brother had been killed in a Dardanelles campaign in June 1915. He's got another brother, Arthur, still serving with the 7th Battalion of the Buffs. Much sympathy is being shown to his parents in a double bereavement. Clark went to the front like all the others, June the 1st, 1915. He played cricket for Aylesford First 11, very popular with all classes. He'd lately been engaged in bomb throwing, and his officer writes of him, writes to his mother, and he says, your son, who was one of the bravest bombers I ever saw, was killed instantly by a bullet when he was in the German trenches. They all died instantly.
They all did, yeah.
Clark, Sergeant Clark, was there when any fighting was to be done, and all his bombers were very fond of him. It was a great blow to us to lose such a fine man. The officers of the company wish me to convey to you the sympathies in your loss. But he has no known grave.
Mm.
He may still be out there, he may still be here. But he's one of those that died here. They said there was 263 casualties amongst the ranks, 11 officers. The Commonwealth War Graves Commission records tell us that 75 Buffs died that day. 42 of them are on Teat Mall, including him. And 15 of them are actually buried in here. The sun is now setting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sunny, the shadows.
Yeah, you can feel.
It's getting a bit chilly again.
Yeah,
but it's still very settled. It's very nice. Bit of a chill in the air now. One of those cemeteries with 3,500 burials that seems to go on forever as it climbs the ridge where we walked just now across there, didn't we? So whenever we come to the village of Ovillers, we think of what happened to the British here in 1916, forgetting that the French fought hard here in Ovillers, in Les Boisselles, and all around here in 1914. And at the back of Ovillers village, looking north towards Teat Bow, I can just see Teat Bow on the horizon. Look, you can just see it. You can see it now. The fog's lifted. You can just see it over there behind me in my kefir. There's a memorial here, a private memorial to the Bretons, and it tells us that on the 17th of December 1914 something happened here on this memorial. You've got a crucifix on the top with Christ being crucified on the cross, and you've got some steps leading up to a stone memorial with some outlines of some crosses on it. And there's an information board here. And it tells us that that memorial was placed here in 1924. It's officially called the Breton Memorial. And there was a family living here called, how do you pronounce that? De Boisanga?
Yeah, Boisanga.
Boisanga, maybe? The Boisanga family took the initiative to erect this memorial here, to dedicate it to the officers and the NCOs and the soldiers of the 19th French Infantry Regiment. And the monument is on the very spot where Lieutenant Augustine Bert de Boisanga, a member of that family, fell to his death on that day, on the date that's on the memorial, the 17th of December 1914. Dear to the hearts of the villages, the monument is now part of the local heritage. And even as we stand here now, there's a young family but disappeared, and I don't think they were here to see that. It's now part of the local heritage, a reminder of the commitment and sacrifice of Breton soldiers on the Picardy soil during the Great War. And we've got some information here about that man that died here, Augustine de Boisanga. He was aged 40. He was called up as a warrant officer, class 2. He joined his regiment at the, on the front. He was quickly promoted to a second lieutenant and then to lieutenant. He was a
says he was a ready volunteer for all dangerous missions. He always offered to take the place of married men as he was himself single. He was more concerned about his neighbour than himself. He didn't hesitate to put his own life at risk in order to rescue the injured that were left behind on the battlefield. And on that day, the 17th of December 1914, just a week before Christmas, he was wounded during a French attack to retake Ovillers from the Germans. To his men who asked him to go back and get treatment from the rear, he said, "I'm not abandoning my Bretons." And just a few minutes later, he was killed. And in that attack on the 17th of December here, it was entrusted to the 19th Infantry Regiment. They were supposed to take Ovillers, and the 118th Regiment was going to take La Boisselle on the other side of the road. And at that time, those two regiments recruited the Bretons almost exclusively. But the enemy, the Germans, as they often are, they were aware of the planned attack, and they'd reinforced the number of soldiers on the front line. Now, at this stage, of course, in December 1914, they wouldn't have the extensive trench system and dugouts that they had 2 years later, but even then, you know, they've got considerable defences. Nevertheless, the command maintained the offensive without preparing the artillery. At 6 o'clock in the morning on the 17th, the soldiers of the 19th Infantry Regiment launched that attack on the German defenders at Ovillers. The assault set off the enemy response, which flattened the men under intense firing and heavy shelling, nailed them to the spot. More than half of the men who tried to fall back were killed where they stood. And like so many of the attacks around here over the years, it was a total and bloody failure. Over 800 men from that regiment were killed, injured, missing, or taken prisoner on that day. So almost like a forgotten action, forgotten period of the war that the French held this place. There is so much bloodshed here at Ovillers, isn't there? So where we are now is, I don't know, a few hundred yards north of Ovillers Cemetery. And the birdsong, I don't know whether you can hear the birdsong, they're out on this beautiful Sunday afternoon. Still a little bit of mist about, isn't there? Still a little bit misty. But we've come across a memorial that I've not seen before, a small memorial, and it says, this is the site of the Ulverston Street Memorial. Now, Ulverston is a town in the Lake District, isn't it? I think it's famous for being Stanlaw's birthplace. And there's an information, but the interesting thing about this memorial is that it's 1915, not 1916. And it tells us that the King's Own Royal Lancaster Regiment from Northwest England was in action here during the autumn-winter period of 1915, so months before the Battle of the Somme. And the trenches in this sector were undoubtedly given their names by soldiers that came from Lancashire and Cumbria, some hailing from Ulverston itself, which later became the town of Albear behind us, the twin town in 1976. And then on the opening day of the Battle of the Somme, 1st of July 1916, the Ulverston Street Trench was occupied by the 2nd Royal Berkshires, whose men left the trench here at 7:30 a.m. to attack. No significant advance was made, with the German 180th Regiment was well prepared, and they fell. Many of them fell here on this spot. So where we're standing is, again, within the 8th Division that we talked about earlier, the 2nd Royal Berkshires attacking towards Ovillers, and many men have died in this area. And around the base of the memorial is lots of debris from the First World War that John, Michael and Susan are peering at, trying to work out what it is. La Boisselle on the right, you can just see the church tower. Number 56, our billet where we're staying. The wide open, unenclosed fields. Down to my left, see Teepval Woods. And then up on the horizon, at sort of 11 o'clock, we can see the mighty Teepval. We can see from so many places here on the Somme battlefield, we can see the Teepval. The mighty Teepval Memorial looking across the battlefield. The valley falls away to what was called Nab Valley, another part of the front line, and it goes up onto the next ridge. So peaceful, we keep saying it, but it's so peaceful. We've got a breath of wind today. Impossible to imagine the scenes that took place here on the 1st of July 1916, the suffering that would have gone on exactly where we're standing, where hundreds, thousands of men, their lives either ended or changed forever.
But there's one postscript to the story of Ovillet, and it comes from a Major Henry Hunt, who was serving with the Royal Engineers. And he went forward to the village of Ovillet. He walked across no man's land, and no doubt he'd have seen the dead, mutilated bodies and those that sadly died of their wounds on the 1st and 3rd of July. Or maybe they died of thirst. He'd have seen all that. But the worst sight he saw was on the German barbed wire, approximately on the site of Ovillet Cemetery, where much of this podcast was recorded. This is what he said about what he found on the barbed wire. Dead British soldiers were hanging on the wire, and the backs of their heads were bashed in. The Germans had either murdered the wounded or mutilated the dead. That no man's land in front of Ovillet was the worst sight I saw in the entire war. We don't know what went on there. Maybe the Germans were putting those poor wounded men hanging on the wire out of their misery. We just don't know. We can't judge. We don't know who those men were, but whoever they were, we will remember them by the sounding of the last post.